I can go back and say that it could have possibly have been harmful for me, but yeah, I mean that's the core of a lot of my work ethic as I grew up, because it really reflected on my parents. They don't have ideal jobs at all whatsoever. At least I don't think so. But if you ask them, like they did what they could, not because it was something that they love, but because their goal and mission in life was to provide for the kids. And that's exactly what they did. So for them, it was a means to an end.
Hi everyone, welcome to the CoLab Collective podcast, where we talk about relevant topics and current events on anything tech related. I'm your producer, Aaron, and hopefully you're having a wonderful day. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time to tuning in to today's episode. For episode number 5, we have special guest Whitmire Vo, and she'll take the time to reflect and speak with Josh about very important changes and transitional periods that she's had in her lifetime. Whenever we are faced with changes and challenges in life, sometimes it's not always the easiest thing to navigate, so she shares her bits and experiences and her knowledge that hopefully will help you, the listener, take it and implement it into your own life. Once again, I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in, and if you have any questions or would like to suggest topics for us to talk about, make sure to reach us at teamcolabco@gmail.com or check out our website at www.colabcollective.ca. Once again, that's www.colabcollective.ca, where you can find more about our initiatives, or hey, if you just want to chat, you can shoot us a message there. Thank you again, and hopefully you enjoy today's episode.
Hey everyone, welcome to CoLab Collective Podcast. Today we have a special guest. I have Whitmire Vo. Oddly enough, I randomly met her on a UX design community and found out that she had pretty similar background as me in engineering. And so she's actually in transition. So I guess if we can start, Whitmire, if you can kind of tell us who you are, what you do, and a little bit of how we met, that'd be a great way to kick us off.
Well, thank you for the introduction. I'd like to express that I'm really excited to be here. So who am I? Don't we all ask ourselves that? So like you said, my name is Whitmire. I am actually based in the States. So I'm in Houston, Texas, not in Vancouver. But
nice.
My background that really connected us was I started in mechanical engineering. That is my trade. I worked in the oil and gas industry for about 5 years. And due to compound economic situations, including the pandemic, I got laid off. And I basically just didn't look back. I kind of picked up, reevaluated the fact that I was living two separate lives in terms of my professional life and my personal life. So that's kind of where I started becoming more explorative about what other career paths I could do that utilizes both my analytical skills, but my creative skills as well. And it led me to UX, led me to some sort of design. That's kind of the space that I want to be in. I'm still trying to figure things out, but I had joined so many online communities, including Iterate UX, which is the community that you and I had met on. So yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's what made us just jump on a call and just to get to know each other even more. And in the past, we have like dove into really deep conversations. So probably within this hour, let's see how deep we can get and explore, various like life topics. But I guess if you can start, like, how did you get into engineering? Because I know I have my story, but if you can share, like, were you just in love with calculating and crunching numbers and all that, and what led you to it?
Right. So I was a natural, I had a natural interest and I guess talent or skill whatever word that you would like to use, in math and science. And as I grew up, actually the first job that I ever really wanted or that I can think of was I wanted to be a fashion designer. My mom's a seamstress, so I was always around clothes. I never realized that alterations was so expensive. So my closet isn't that expensive, but if you put on top of all of the free labor of love that my mom has put in terms of alterations with my closet, I think my closet would be quite expensive. So I really wanted to be a fashion designer. I just was very infatuated with how you can express yourself aesthetically. And then I think growing up biculturally, I'm Vietnamese American. So my parents are immigrants. I grew up in a culture with very traditional Vietnamese values. And it was pretty immediate for my family to say, it's a very hard field. You're not going to make that much money. And, you know, I believed that.
Right.
And so every occupation that I can think of that I wanted to be after a fashion designer just became more and more practical. So it was a fashion designer to an interior designer to an architect. And then eventually, I think if I didn't have the self-doubt, I probably would have pursued architecture in my teens. And then, but for whatever reason, actually, no, I do know the reason. I did an architecture program and I thought to myself, man, I really enjoy this, but is this worth me losing so much sleep? Do I love it that much to not make such a great living? And those were these narratives and illusions that I told myself whenever I was 17. And I believed it. So then I decided to go into engineering. I picked mechanical engineering because I picked the most generic thing.
Wow.
And yeah, so then I, you know, fast forward 10 years later, that was the mindset of how I got into engineering. And now I'm kind of backtracking back into those fields that I was interested in when I was younger.
That's so interesting because I definitely didn't have an interest in like fashion design, but I definitely wanted to be an architect. So that's what got me into engineering. So I kind of followed a similar route. And yeah, I totally get it. I kept on hearing like if you wanted to be an architect, you had to be like the best for you to stand
right.
out.
Because same as me.
Yeah, you're either like really, really amazing or you just kind of fade off into just a regular architect, and they usually don't get paid as much. So people kept on saying, just be an engineer. It's you get paid more and you do a little bit less.
those were narratives that really sold me. Right. And, you know, I will say that I don't think that it was a mistake for me to go into engineering. I do think that it was a suitable career choice for me at that time. And, you know, one word that I really love and is it, at that time, I satisfies, right? For what I knew and a decision that needed to be made at that time, I made the best choice that I thought with the given available information.
Right.
Now, if I didn't grow up biculturally, who knows where I'll be? Maybe I would be a starving artist.
So yeah, the culture and the family definitely had a huge influence on your decision.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that family and culture had a big influence and still do in me as a person. And it's not just exclusive to my career.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think that it is a disadvantage or it's a crutch. I think it has provided me an opportunity to really understand what values I can, you know, what values hold near and dear to me. Because growing up, I really thought that the values that my parents, my family instilled in me were just logically had to be my own values. But when you grow up in a home where it really conflicts with what is happening outside of the home, I think as a young kid, especially for myself, it was really, it was just confusing. And I think that was something that really contributed to how I made my career choices, where I moved to, and, you know, just in general, like how I kind of navigate life.
Right. So what were some of the things that you picked up in engineering? Because I know, like, you being in oil and gas, and I've been in the mining industry for a little while and did some drilling. So I think some of the experiences is really rare that you picked up. And I remember you telling me how, you know, you really learned about resilience. Can you kind of share a little bit about that and, like, you know, your experience with, like, Schlumberger and the whole thing in a nutshell?
Yeah. So, you know, to go back to you asking how I chose my career path, I had mentioned before I'm based in Houston. So that's where I was born and raised. And it's the oil capital of the States. Actually, I would think in the world. So it's our version of Calgary.
Got it.
And in Canada. And so, you know, I didn't want to really go into oil and gas. That's not necessarily a field that I really resonated with and, you know, saw their mission in life.
Pretty beautiful.
Oh, I love wearing coveralls. Yeah. Like, actually the reason why I wanted to work out in the field, and for anyone that's listening and don't really have a concept of what I did in my past career, you know, when you're driving somewhere and you see an oil rig or some pump jack, or something that you think is extracting oil, I was a person that actually went out there and stayed out there for X amount of hours, days, time.
So these are like 12-hour shifts?
No, I was on call 24/7. I worked a rotational schedule. So I worked 2 weeks on, 1 week off, and that was a typical rotation for me. And it varied from time to time, but in general, that kind of gives you just like a very over like high level of what I did. But the things that I learned from being out in the field, out in the oil rigs, was, like you said, a lot of resilience. I can tell you, I couldn't tell you how much sleep I lost. I can't tell you how hard it was to keep going every day in such a stressful environment. And I do very well in general in a demanding role. You know, I'm very attuned to deadlines. I do try to exude effective communication cross-functionally. But the problem with like the roles that I had in my career was the fact that you know, it was just really hard to say no sometimes, especially because it was so demanding, like mentally, physically. I remember, so for me, if I'm sleep deprived, and sleep deprivation was a big thing during my career, was I would just cry. I would laugh at literally everything. And then at a flip of a switch, I would cry because I just wanted sleep, right? Like I just wanted sleep. But, you know, it did get to the point where I was able to say no. There was a point where I was able to say, I can't do this anymore. Because I think that those are the times where it really tests your patience. But it also breaks you too. That's how you burn out and whatnot. But I will say that there were a lot of valuable experiences that came out of it. Like, you know, when you go through such demanding times with people, like my colleagues, I always trusted them to have my back in most situations. And so you really build this like kinship that is very similar to people working in military or, you know, right now, doctors, the nurses, medical, anyone that's in the medical front line, they're probably experiencing a lot of hardship right now. And there's a camaraderie that comes with that because you're all experiencing it together. And I think that just doesn't come up in
typical 9-to-5 office job.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think everyone can say that you bond with your coworkers when you're complaining about work. But there is a next level whenever you are really like suffering together. You know, these are not ideal conditions. Think of any type of weather condition. I have worked in it. I've worked in negative degree weather. I have worked in over 100 degree weather. I've worked in the middle of a blizzard, a tornado, a like tropical storm.
Wow.
So anytime when people see the weather and say like how it's terrible outside, you know, one thing that I always think about is, at least I'm not working outside.
Right. Yeah, totally. I'm really grateful for like where we're at now and being in tech. It's completely opposite. So you've been tested physically, mentally, emotionally, and it kind of brought you to like a whole new level of resilience and also appreciation, because through that, I guess, hardship, you do form that bond. So was there a certain point that you can remember where it's like, I'm done? Or obviously, like, you know, you've gone through like a lot, like many of other people out there, a lot of layoffs and everything. And so this is probably a moment for you to just maybe shift and pivot. But at what point did you start to question and like, this is probably not for me. Maybe, you know, I've put enough time in this. What were your thought process? I'm like, maybe I should switch.
So let me set the stage.
Sure.
You know, whenever you are a kid and you're watching cartoons and there's a character that is in jail and they're just marking with a piece of chalk that you then question how they got that piece of chalk on the wall or some rock. And it's just like counting down the days that they are there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was me since the beginning. And I think, you know, going back to adopting these values from my family, my family is incredibly resilient. And there's a term in Vietnamese called gan, and my mom uses it a lot. She always says like minh gan lam, which means like we have to persevere through the hard times. And I think for me it was maybe my definition of a work ethic of, you know, this is just how things are. Like, I really believe that this is just how things are. I should be grateful for the fact that I do have a job, a well-paying job at that. And, you know, there is nothing that I can't do. And, you know, I can go back and say that it could have possibly have been harmful for me. But, I mean, that's the core of a lot of my work ethic as I grew up, because it really reflected on my parents. You know, they don't have ideal jobs at all whatsoever. Mm-hmm. At least I don't think so. But if you ask them, like, they did what they could, not because it was something that they love, but because their goal and mission in life was to provide for the kids. And that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. So for them, it was a means to an end, and they were going past the everyday mundane things, you know, all the small things that we endure on a regular basis, especially for both my parents being blue collar workers. And I was essentially a blue collar worker when I was working in the oil field.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, like it was often. I question being out there often. Anytime I lost sleep, anytime I got a phone call at 3 a.m. in the morning after just being back at 7 p.m. the day before. Not being able to sleep in my own bed for 2 weeks because mm-hmm. we're that busy, we're that shorthanded. I mean, you have to understand that whenever I started in the downturn. So that was a big question there. It was one of the biggest downturns that we had seen aside from COVID, where it was the first time that oil and gas had really shifted in the way where it wasn't just like these big companies that had just so much money. Mm. You know, they would blow money like no tomorrow. I'd say that I think all the times that I had questioned whether I should leave, or the times that I should, you know, do something else, I think I used a lot of toxic positivity reasoning.
Okay.
So for me, it was, you know, I don't have a better option right now, or, you know what, right now it's just currently working out for me. I will say the schedule, even as harsh as it was in terms of working schedule, the fact that I was able to, you know, not work for a third of the year or any of those cases was pretty awesome. So I got to do a lot of traveling. And the grass is always greener on the other side. And I do truly believe that. The fact that even though there are certain things that can be better, the grass is always greener on the other side. And there is not one situation where it is always going to be, you know, rainbows and glitters. So I think at that time, any time that the thought had arisen that I was going to leave or wanting to leave, it was just me thinking like, well, this just works out for right now.
Right.
But that didn't stop my curiosity with trying to figure out other options, you know, in my downtime.
Okay. So yeah, maybe you can share a little bit about that. Like when you started getting that itch, like, okay, as each year goes by, you're figuring out this can't last long. Did you start looking back at like fashion design, or like how did you make your way into like UX design, or are you still kind of in the midst of shifting and exploring and looking at different options?
You know, I'm always exploring.
Okay. So how early did you look into tech?
Yeah, so I had really thought about it, I'd say 2018.
Okay.
And like the middle of 2018. And it was funny because 2 years before that, a friend of mine who is a back-end developer, he was like, Whitmire, you should look into UX design. And I blew him off. I was like, I don't have time for this.
And you had no idea what it was before.
I had no idea what it was. Oh, how naive I was. But, you know, fast forward 2 years later, I don't even remember how I came about UX design. Like, I could not tell you how I even came upon the subject, but I did. And I have a natural interest in cognitive science. Like, most of my podcasts are about psychology, human behavior, how we act. You know, behavioral economics. And I guess after that, it was just a rabbit hole of getting down to UX design. And so I thought, oh, well, this speaks to me, right? Like, yeah. I get to use my analytical skills. I get to use my creative skills. I get to use my interpersonal skills. And that is something that I, you know, use a lot on a regular basis. I am an extrovert. And so even though I do have introvert tendencies. So once I got into the idea, I mean, I can tell you that I'm quite ambitious, but I think there was a real fear in like making that jump, doing something that I could potentially be bad at, considering that I was really good at my current profession, even though I knew I wasn't going to be there long term. I knew that. I knew that regardless of what position that they would give me, it would just, even if I became like one of the top execs, I knew that it was not a place that I wanted to be. I knew that. I just never left. But, you know, in hindsight, I'm glad I didn't leave because I got a severance out of it.
I'm sure there are so many people out there who are listening, and I was in the same boat, still kind of come out of it that like they have this secure spot or position, whatever it's in professional jobs in engineering or accounting or medicine or whatnot or something else. So let's talk about like that. There's that fear. It's like
leaving
this place of certainty that's secure, but it's not like your heart's not there. So at what point do you just like take that leap, like having that courage?
Step out. The things, yeah. So I'd say if I were to give myself advice, I'd say in the last 5 years, actually since the beginning of my professional career, one thing I probably would have wished that someone had told me was just do some volunteer work, and not volunteer work in the sense of, you know, go to a food bank and or like a soup kitchen, but do volunteer work that actually outputs some sort of skill. Because in that case, you can learn a different skill. It is real world application, and you can feel good about yourself. I mean, you don't have to commit to so much time, it's not another job. You don't have any ties. You do have a stakeholder, which is whatever organization that you are, you're doing work for, but I think that's what I would have done differently, because I think at that time, whenever I had thought about UX design, I just thought about the education part, like, oh, this is going to take so much like time for me to read about all these things and, build a portfolio, things like that. And I think one thing that I have really done, especially during the pandemic, is just trying to figure out how to connect with people afar. So all of my work has been with people that I've never met before in person. And I think that would have been probably the difference between me 5 years ago, where having a growth mindset, because I do think that I was quite closed-minded, thinking with the illusion of thinking that I did have a growth mindset, right? Thinking like, oh, the world is my oyster, which by the way, like having so many options is definitely very overwhelming. Like I can't tell you how overwhelmed I felt finally realizing that, oh, the world is my oyster and I have no idea where to even begin.
Right.
Options do not make us happier.
It's like, paralysis of analysis, right?
When you're right, it's like one to three options. That's why I like going to restaurants that have set menus. I don't have to pick. Stay away from the like Vietnamese and Chinese restaurants that have like these binders for their menus, and you're just kind of flipping through, but you still order the same like five dishes.
Or order the house special D9 or something.
Yeah, in Vietnamese, that's the Dak Biệt.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So I think there is that fear. And I wouldn't fault anyone for not making that leap. I don't think that you are a weak person for not taking the leap of, what you think your heart is calling out to. But I do think that if you have some sort of curiosity of anything, just try to find an organization that could use your help. And I think the easiest way for you to shift over to something that is more of interest is, you know, I'm an engineer. I could have done some sort of design work in for, you know, some sort of organization and then kind of like transition over into UX. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always have to be a slow progression, but it doesn't always have to be a quick progression. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that we are in an age where patience really is an art, and we don't have that appreciation for patience, right? Patience, persistence, and that's where we have really like breeded ourselves to be. You know, you can probably see someone, you could see like the true person with slow Wi-Fi.
That's a great, great example.
Like, I would just rather have no Wi-Fi than slow Wi-Fi.
Right.
That's just me.
That is true. Because having slow Wi-Fi, you have that expectation that something's going to load, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I would imagine that is probably a lot of the fear too, is am I going to fail? You know, how long is this going to take? How much am I going to lose? And, you know, what's funny is that I thought of all those things. Mm-hmm. And I even told myself that it wouldn't have been that big of a risk because I had a well-paying job. I mean, shoot, I lived with my parents for a really long time. I still do. Mm-hmm. Because they live in a big house. And, you know, even though I can absolutely afford a place of my own, of a decent sized home. You know, even my parents said, like, there's no point of wasting your money in a home if one, you don't want to live right in that house. Since at that, so before COVID, I was traveling a lot, right? Like, this is the first time that I have been in one place for longer than 2 months in like 10 years.
Wow.
So I was always on the go. So it's nice to like finally be in one place for a little bit. I don't think that's the long-term plan for me, but it is nice, you know, appreciate the things that you don't, that aren't very common in your life. Yeah. So, I mean, I ran through all of that risk mitigation thinking like, you know, I can financially afford it. Mm-hmm. I think it was just like the pure fear of failing and facing yourself like, man, you really suck at this. But we suck at everything when we start off. And, you know, it really is hard to convince your emotional self with your intellectual self. Mm. You know, it's the same reason why people still smoke, people still drink. People don't care about numbers. They don't care about what the facts are. It still makes them feel good. It still makes them like numb to whatever they want to be numb to, or it satisfies a certain need, a certain itch. So fear is the same thing. It's everything that is comfortable gives us that immediate satisfaction.
Right.
But how you break away from fear is, you know, if you're not ready to take risk and just like pull off the band-aid, you know, in our case, our Asian parents and say like, no, we're going to do it this way. Well, they just do it gradually.
Yeah, that's a huge one for a lot of Asian families.
So you can still have your job.
Yeah.
You can still be that doctor, that lawyer, that engineer. All the stereotypical Asian roles and still get paid very well, but also at the same time, build a craft that lights your soul for an hour a day.
Right. So for you, like, what is it about UX design that you're really enjoying now that really, you know, attracts your interest?
So I'd say that the things that attracted me to UX when I had first discovered it are not the same things that attract me now to UX design. So in the beginning, it was, I think what attracted me, it was the fact that I felt it was a role or an occupation that really resonated with me. I was like, oh yeah, I can use my analytical skills, my people skills, my creative skills. And it really encompassed like all of the aspects of myself that I can put into this role. Mm. Now, those still all apply, but I think right now what really fascinates me about UX design is how we solve problems. And we solve problems like not in the right way. Mm. Especially as an engineer, a lot of the things, like a lot of the times that engineers can be very guilty of is like, how do we build this?
Right.
This is something that I'm envisioning. Mm-hmm. How do we build that? And it lacks the empathy. It lacks sometimes the applicability or it lacks a lot of things that would actually make a product sell.
Right. So more of like the preceding context. More the why as opposed to just the what and the how.
Yeah, so it's really helped me view how we solve problems in general. And, you know, design thinking is something that I try to apply in my own life outside of my professional life. And that was always the goal. It wasn't the goal that I was going to find a job that I absolutely love. I think in general, that's hard for a lot of people to find. We don't have the immediate accessibility to know what our passion is, but we do have the accessibility of curiosity. So I ran with my curiosity. Mm-hmm. But I think that whenever I was starting into UX design, it really made me question like everything and question things in a way where like, how can I design this better? Is this actually the right problem that we're solving?
Yeah.
Is this something that people even want? Mm-hmm. Is this something that we even need? And those are not questions that I had ever really asked. Mm. You know, it was just someone approaching me with, here's this problem, go fix it.
Right.
And, you know, when the immediate, and I blame school for this. I can't say for private school because I didn't go to private school, but I blame the American public's education on when you're given a problem, you immediately solve a problem. Mm-hmm. And typically there's one right answer.
Yeah. You're.
And that's just not true.
Yeah. You're not alone in that. I mean, I think same with our system too, right? It's very catered towards just providing a problem here and then you just solve it. And you're kind of like taking orders or just doing it without, yeah, again, questioning like why or is this even effective or are there other better ways or alternative solutions?
Yeah, the way that schools are set up, it is, you know, we haven't innovated the school system in a very long time. And the way school is set up now has a lot to do with how, like, a lot of the available jobs that were more in demand back then. And those were industry workers, people who were doing the same thing every single day, frontline workers, things like that, or even the military, like going to the military. You know, but now not everyone is like that. I'm a huge proponent of school is not for everyone, but we should also advocate for other avenues that would still foster some sort of success, like margin of success rather than a certification. Mm-hmm. You know, my brother actually had a really good insight, and he said never go to school for a certification or like don't do a course just for the certification. Like, do it for the education. And, you know, that says a lot for my brother, because at one point he had dropped out of college. And then he eventually went back and finished, but not until years later. So, yeah, I think we hold these labels in not the most healthy way.
Right.
So how do we redesign school?
Yeah, I think this is like, I think education, online education, is definitely shifting, like, and it's changing a lot even during through COVID. So I think we're probably going to see a lot of things moving in the next few years.
Yeah, I think it's also like the pure volume of people that we have to be taught, right? Like my nephew is 5 years old, and right now I help him with his virtual schooling. And I don't necessarily agree with how they teach virtual schooling, but that it's not that I'm really conflicted, obviously. I'm stumbling over my words. But what I will say is, one thing I really think about a lot is, how do you foster that curiosity? How do you lead your kids in a way where they can be self-sufficient and have the tools to really feel like they can tackle anything in this world? You know, and that takes a lot of attention from the guardians, from a household, from like literally everyone. Because kids are, you know, I love kids in like a social experiment kind of way. I love observing kids because they're such weird people. But I also think that they are the most, they're the most purest.
Right.
Too.
Yeah.
They don't have any concept of where things should be. And I say should because we have made that. They don't have a concept of time. They don't have a concept of their own existence in relation to the world. They have literally relinquished the idea of the self. And, you know, we can go into the idea of like meditation. And if you think of everything that is associated with the meditation practice, and, you know, we can go all the way up to the top of like Nirvana. I think those are kids because they don't have that. I mean, I'll see my nephew color a mouse green because he just wants to. And yeah, because why not? But those are not the types of decisions that we make as adults.
Right.
The idea of fear.
Right. Yeah.
You know, kids feel, it's not like kids don't feel emotions. We see it all the time. They just show the rawest emotion in an instant. But after that, they forget. You know, it is past them. They have saw beyond what had just happened. They don't really hold these grudges, and they just keep moving forward.
And I'm sure if they had an engineering career early on, I'm sure they wouldn't have that fear to stop them, right? So it's like nothing stops them. They can just, they feel like doing it, they'll do it.
Yeah. So maybe the advice here is just to be a kid.
Yeah, no, I think there's something really, like you said, pure about like the wonder and the curiosity from like a child's point of view.
You have a 2-year-old. How has it been to observe your child?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, a 2-month-old. Yeah. How has it been to just observe your daughter in the last 2 months? Like, I'm sure it's fascinating for you.
Yeah.
Also frightening at the same time, because you're just thinking like, I don't want to mess you up.
Well, I think as you're sharing that, I'm like, yeah, I think it's such a gift to, I was just listening to a talk recently, how almost, you know, we go through life and we get mired through like life experience, and we fill ourselves with like shoulds. And then when we have kids, it's almost like a gift for them to kind of remind us to, look with like a fresh new perspective with no judgment, and kind of brings us back. So they kind of restore that sense of curiosity and innocence. So
do you ever see yourself as a child?
Myself?
Yeah.
In what way?
Like how we treat our kids, I think, is how we should treat ourselves.
Mm.
You know, with that care, that compassion, that empathy that they, you know, if they're struggling through something, you're like, man, I understand. It is hard.
Yeah.
But you could totally do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Man, that's a good question. I would say yes and no. Yes, as in I think I try to come to that point where I'm just like present. But it's no, because like I have these things to consider and to look after her and to, you know, look out for the threats out there and risk and protect. So I think that's just like part of parenthood. So it's been a roller coaster. So it's a big learning curve for sure.
You know, life is a roller coaster.
So I want to end off with this. Like, so I know you've taken some time during, you know, this period and season of your life where you're learning a lot, you're exploring a lot. And even, yeah, during this, you're not working and stuff like that. So what are some things that you've done to, gain some clarity in like say going forward? Because I know for me, before I went to UX, I actually took a year off, and it was one of the most amazing times because I just gave myself permission to explore and to look and all that. So what kind of stuff have you been doing?
Well, we don't have another hour, so I'll try to keep this short. I'd say that in the very beginning, after I got laid off, I think the natural inclination for myself was, I need to fix this. I need to get another job. I need to try to figure it out. And I'd say that really brought me to a place that I had to ask myself some pretty hard questions. Because I think talking about that fear, I think a lot of that fear has more to do with a fear of disappointing our own selves rather than other people. Even though we'll probably say, like, I don't want to disappoint my family. I don't want to disappoint, you know, my spouse, my children, whatever the case may be. But in my case, I had to do a lot of introspective work.
Right.
And that took a lot of meditation. At one point, I was at a pretty dark place, so I had to seek for help. So I got a therapist. I did some like group therapy, and it was all very centric around the fact that I was a confused child with this bicultural. With these bicultural values. And I think with doing all this introspective work, it gave me a lot of clarity on where, like, the root of all the procrastination. Because, you know, when we are afraid to do something, that just leads to procrastinating, putting it off, saying that you're going to do it again in a week, whatever the case may be. And I really had to dive deep and understanding like what is causing all of this procrastination. And for me, it was, I just didn't want to disappoint myself. Like I had always been very afraid to do things that I thought were like, I knew that long-term it would be a better fit for me, even if it wasn't lucrative or whatever the case may be. But I think having the last 2 months to solve or face the issues that have been, you know, basically been like my ghosts for a very long time. You know, that's scary. Like to sit down and have a conversation with yourself in a constructive way, not in a, you know, a belittling, judgmental kind of way, but in a constructive way to really understand, like, why am I feeling this way? Why am I procrastinating? Why has it been so hard for me to convince myself, even though intellectually I really do understand all of the benefits? Why is it taking so much willpower for me to make a switch over? So I think for anyone who is facing these fears and trying to get some clarity, I think the work that needs to be done has more to do of introspective work than the work that you produce, especially in design, because we hear a lot that practice makes perfect, that, you know, output a high volume of work and then pick and choose for your portfolio. And I do think that those are all viable, applicable advice. But I think that if you want to be thoughtful about how you want to proceed in life, in whatever decisions, whatever whatever changes, it has more to do with yourself,
right?
And understanding that, you know, finding yourself does not mean taking a trip to Bali and staying there for, you know, a month and having people question on your Instagram how the hell you can afford that lifestyle.
Have you been to Bali, by the way?
I have not.
Okay.
I have not. But right. But yeah, just really sitting with yourself and asking, like, okay, this is how I'm feeling. And, you know, where does that come from? And typically we kind of stop there. We stop at the first two whys, and they're typically not the root cause. So actually applying design thinking to your introspective work, can be quite useful, right? Because you're asking yourself a whole slew of whys until you can ask no more. You know, it's the,
you get down to the Don, core.
Yeah. It's the Don Norman effect of just ask why, ask why, ask why until you can ask no more. Yeah. So I, for me to try to find clarity, and that's a life's work, that, that can't be done in X amount of time, but it really had to start with me and really understanding, like, what do I want to exude? How do I want to use up my energy? How, and I want to loosely use, like, defining who you are as a person, because the things that you do doesn't really define who you are. But, you know, I don't really tie myself to my own work, and I don't, and a lot of designers do, but for me, I just wanted to be a better person, but really also like to show up for myself, because I feel like I really neglected that for a while, even if I was quote unquote having a really good life. I probably, I mean, I can tell you that I do have a good life. And if I were to pass in the near future, I mean, like, if I told you everything that I did in this world, I had been very fortunate enough to do some amazing things that the average person wouldn't be able to do in their lifetime. But that doesn't equate to me understanding who I am. And I think in this time where we have this opportunity to, you know, really sit with ourselves and sit in this uncomfortable setting, is, can be very profound. And it's really given me a lot of clarity on what my triggers are, what my crutches are, the things that are holding me back, the things I'm afraid of. And even that, it's hard to even say aloud, but to be able to identify those, I think, like, I could be proud of myself, or I am proud of myself, to even gain a little bit of clarity that will set me for, you know, a lifetime. At least I hope so.
That is awesome. I really want to acknowledge you, because it takes a lot to, I guess, sit with yourself, sit with your thoughts. And it, like you said, it can take you to dark places, but it's kind of through pushing through the fear that's where a lot of the growth happens, right? So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. With adversity, there is opportunity.
Love it. That's so good. I think we just got really deep, and I think it's a perfect spot to end.
And we were under the hour.
Yeah.
That's an accomplishment for us.
That was great. Fantastic.
I think the audience should know that since Josh and I have met, all of our calls have been well over
an hour.
An hour, but I'm pretty sure an hour and a half. I think our longest conversation was 3 hours, and we've only known each other for, I guess, a month at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, you can build meaningful connections and engagement virtually.
Agreed. Totally agreed. Well, thanks so much. I don't know if we should kind of summarize. That was a lot. I think, if you were to summarize that, what would you say?
I'd say, to summarize our conversation, we talked a lot about what holds us back from transitioning from something that's so comfortable to something that is very uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to take that leap, it takes persistence and slow progress, especially if you are not, you're not a risk taker.
Mm-hmm.
Give yourself the time, allow yourself the time to build the skill, and to end it off, you know, this, to really overcome your fear in general, is to get a sense of clarity. And that starts with yourself, not right. with any environmental or external factors.
Yeah, that's perfect. Start with the inside out. I do want to mention that, you know, how you said you saw a therapist and you reached out in these like certain programs or groups. I think that is so important to embrace, because I think there's a lot of stigma, especially for guys. If we're kind of sensing things are off, we don't want to like talk about it. We just keep it to ourselves. But I think, you know, people go to the gym for being healthy physically, and when it comes to the inside stuff or the internal things, seeing a therapist or a counselor is just like going to the gym for your mind, for your body, or for your heart. So I think that's really, it's really great, and it's healthy to do. So hopefully this encourages everyone who's listening to kind of take the time, have clarity, find who you are, that's really where the confidence lies. And we talk about like going into interviews, we're not really defined about what we do or the external outputs or our achievements, but it's really just who we are intrinsically. And from that, I believe like good things and good work come out of that place. So are there any resources or things that you can recommend, Whitmire? Like, I know we're talking about the personality test in terms of like clarity and stuff like that. Any good things to share?
You know, I have a lot of resources when it comes to introspective work, but I'll start with, that's hard. You know, I'll say this in terms of resources, get help if you think that you need it. So, you know, obviously I do think that all help is different. So if one option is not what you think is the best fit, listen to that and move on to the next option. And be vulnerable with people, because how I found my therapist was through a friend who is not, you know, is not Asian or a woman, but he was able to provide me a resource that that has really helped me. So, you know, be vulnerable to your support group, whoever you think that you can trust the most with you during your hardest time. But I'd say, like, for fun reads, one thing would be Designing Your Work Life. I think that's a good book.
Okay.
And they also have Design Your Life. So it's a series. So I think in terms of designers, I think those are good ways to start in terms of trying to figure out how to get yourself from point A to point B.
Perfect. All right. I will link that book in the description. Thanks so much, Whitmire. It's awesome. Thanks for sharing your wise experience. And if you guys are looking for help, do reach out to us or want to contact us and have any questions after this podcast, email us at teamcollabco@gmail.com or visit our website at collabcollective.ca. If you like this podcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, give us a 5 out of 5 and drop us a comment. That'd be great. And we'd always want to improve. So with that, have a fantastic day. And we'll talk to you guys or see you guys in the next one.